Fascism is a fear of freedom triggered by a glimpse of people achieving freedom who shouldn't really have freedom. The idea that migration is a form of genocide against white people. The perpetrator of the genocide is liberalism, because liberalism allowed the migrants in and feminism depressed the white birth rate. And it drives the people who it radicalizes towards violent ends. The idea of a violent, world-ending insurrection. And of the left, it demands action. It demands that we focus and prioritize. We need an alliance of liberalism and the left to defend democracy. Any leftist who tells you that we can't, no, just ignore them. They are going to lead you to the same disaster that they led you to in the 1930s. They don't realize that this battle is the battle for Western civilization.
Thank you so much, guys, for tuning in to this week's episode of the Dissents Podcast. I'm your host, Lukas Ondrejka, and I'm honored to be joined by Paul Mason, activist and writer. His latest book, How to Stop Fascism, has just been translated into German, and Paul was so kind to join me here on the show to talk about resisting and defeating the new far right. Paul, the last decade we've seen the far right on the rise, so much is evident, but I think what's not that well understood is actually what are the reasons for the return of fascism.
Yep.
So why do you think fascism is on the rise again?
I think we're living through a period of breakdown, and not just the breakdown of an economic model, what we call neoliberalism, which blew up in the global financial crisis of 2008. Far more importantly for me, is the breakdown of the neoliberal ideology. Because the neoliberal ideology was a kind of economic doctrine that explained everything. In fact, there's a great quote from my friend and colleague Will Davis, who works at Goldsmiths University, and he calls neoliberalism the disenchantment of politics by economics. So you could almost say the conversion of politics into economics. And so neoliberalism said to two generations of people, as long as you obey the market, you will be okay. The market is like an all-knowing, intelligent machine which can think better than you. I mean, I grew up in the 1960s, and the ideology I grew up with, we could describe it as Keynesian, as the Keynesian world, the welfare state, the idea that the state will look after you. But it wasn't an all-encompassing ideology. It didn't claim to explain everything. Neoliberalism claimed everything. And so when it blows up and no longer explains the world, the market no longer delivers benign outcomes, and the pursuit of individualism no longer delivers benign outcomes, people begin to ask the question, what other ideologies are there? Because we kept a kind of zombie neoliberal economic system alive through quantitative easing, through central bank money creation. But you can't keep an ideology alive that way, because the human brain demands coherence. And so I was very influenced by the work of Karl Mannheim in the 1920s. Mannheim is trying to understand why the Weimar Republic doesn't work and why people are rushing to the extremes of politics, Nazism and the KPD. And Mannheim's explanation is this: in normal times, there is ideology, and the ideology is kind of a common sense, and it works because it's reinforced by everyday experience. But in abnormal times, the ideology breaks down and people seek utopias. What I think we're seeing with the rise of the far right this time, even though the far right are small in terms of political parties and voting share, we're seeing a mass search for a utopia, a utopian solution to the problem that the economy is busted and the reigning ideology no longer makes sense. It's very different. We should discuss the differences between now and the 1930s. But that one similarity of the breakdown of the ideology is the key to understanding why people are rushing to the extremes.
Yeah, and we're certainly going to talk more about the breakdown of neoliberal ideology, how the new far right is trying to fill that political vacuum, and what we're going to do to stop them. But first, I briefly want to take a look back how we ended up here, because, Paul, I think there was for a long time the belief that fascism is a thing of the past, that human progress and capitalist globalization would lead us to more peaceful societies and make us sort of immune to fascism.
Yeah.
And now for the last couple of years, we actually see fascist ideology on the rise again, and we see, I think, a dangerous connection between between fascism on the one hand and right-wing populist and authoritarians on the other hand, such as Trump, Bolsonaro, and Putin. Have we been naive to assume that our democracies would be immune to the rise of fascism? What do you think, Paul?
We are certainly not immune to it. What I argue in the book is that fascism, it's no clear that fascism is a recurrent feature of capitalist breakdown. It was fair to assume after the Second World War that it could have been a one-off, that it was the result of specific features of Germany and Italy and Spain and specific problems of economic breakdown. It was fair to assume that. And indeed, my parents' generation did assume it. My mother was half Jewish, and, you know, she assumed it. She assumed that that world had gone. There was no need to revisit the imagery of it, and it was better to forget it. So when I was first active in the anti-fascist movement in the late 1970s, we used to chant "Never again" at the Nazi skinheads, almost as a victory slogan, like, "Yeah, never again can you strut around the world seeking Lebensraum," you know, and we thought they were just a joke. But now it's now clear that "never again" was only an aspiration. And unfortunately, it's a failed aspiration. And I think that a lot of the reasons I wanted to write this book is because neither the liberal theory of fascism, nor academic theories of fascism, nor indeed the Marxist theory of fascism fully explains why we are seeing the recurrence of the phenomenon in a different form. And, you know, it's a very different question. Why did fascism happen to why is it happening again? I think that it's proven by the emergence. Now, you mentioned Trump, you mentioned Bolsonaro, you mentioned Putin, and we should talk about Putin. These are not fascist politicians. They are, I would argue, right-wing nationalist and in some cases ethno-nationalist politicians who very clearly belong in the category right-wing populism. The problem is political science, having spent 20 or 30 years establishing separate categories like authoritarian conservative, right-wing populist, fascist, the problem is all of these strands of politics, parts of conservatism, all of populism, all of fascism, are now structured around the same thought architecture, the same logic. That's what's changed. Because you could argue in the 1990s, when right-wing populism emerged, the average right-wing populist was saying to you things like, "I don't like migrants. I don't like the smell of foreign people's food. I don't like the fact that nobody asked me whether or not there should be more migration." Now, their thought is structured around feminism being a form of suppression of men, liberalism being a form of oppression of white people. They have a fully theorized view of the world that is fascist. And the fascist ideologues, Dugin is a great example. Dugin, I think, has become more and more relevant in light of the invasion of Ukraine. But Dugin is one, Cavallo is another. There are numerous fascist ideologists whose clear vision of the world, of large, ethnically pure states at war with each other, that vision has begun to structure the thinking of the small-town, small-time, prejudiced person who used to only worry about halal food. That's what's changed.
I think it would be a good time now to talk about what modern fascism and fascist ideology actually look like, because contemporary fascism shares a lot with its historical predecessors, but it also is quite different, especially when it comes to strategies, tactics, and communication. So, Paul, tell us a bit about what's at the core of the fascist belief system and fascist politics today.
The first thing to say is that the new form of fascist belief system structures the way they do their politics. And in turn, their new belief system is structured by the problem of imperialism, the specific form of imperialism we're living through. So for me, there are five parts to the thought architecture of modern fascism. I will list them. Number one, the great replacement theory, the idea that migration is a form of genocide against white people. Point two, the perpetrator of the genocide is liberalism, because liberalism allowed the migrants in and feminism depressed the white birth rate. So that's kind of point 2A, 2B, anti-liberal, anti-feminist. Point three, beneath it all, there is cultural Marxism. This is not an accident. In fact, for fascists, both in the 30s and today, nothing can be an accident. Everything has to be planned by somebody. And the people planning it are the cultural Marxists, the Frankfurt School, Herbert Marcuse, and their followers. And they have decided to destroy the West through cultural liberalism and social liberalism, gay rights, etc. And it's very interesting in this sense that in the 30s, if you look at the relationship between Bolshevism and Jewishness in Nazi ideology, then Jews are often depicted as the so-called carriers of Bolshevism. Mm-hmm. You know, like a rat carries plague. This was a common theme in Nazism. So what you now see is that liberals and feminists are inadvertent carriers of cultural Marxism. That's the structure. So we get to point three, cultural Marxism. Mm-hmm. Point four is, what do you do about it? You do metapolitics. You win an ideological argument. You repeat an ideological argument through memes, through gestures, and again and again through symbolic violence. So you're not trying to seize power. There is no march on Rome. There is no beer hall putsch in the current iteration of fascism, because what you need to do is to create a community of people ready for point five. And point five is what we call day X. It's the deluge, Armageddon, when a mass outbreak of racial violence engulfs the world. Whether it's the civil war in America, whether it's what we're seeing now with Russia's invasion of Ukraine, which I argue is a pure example of an ethno-nationalist war. Mm. The fascists of today fantasize about a great breakdown, out of which emerges this world once imagined by Carl Schmitt, the Nazi ideologist. You know, large spaces ruled by single governments and societies which are homogeneous, which cannot tolerate heterogeneity. That's the vision. So if you think that's coming, and climate change tells you that you have a good chance of indeed the world collapsing into large ethnically defined monostates, and indeed the Russo-Ukrainian war tells you what that might look like, and the genocide in Xinjiang against the Uyghur people tells you what that might look like, you can wait. If there is a finality to history coming, and it's a different kind of end of history than the one imagined by Fukuyama. When Fukuyama imagined the Nietzschean end of history, this is the triumph of the will that is coming. And if you think it's coming, then you wait, and you don't. In fact, what you do is you live inside the counterculture. If these five things structure fascism, then what it then structures is a form of behavior. And the behavior is primarily metapolitical. It's constantly telling stories, gathering recruits. It's a quasi-religious conversion experience. And it's why I've gone back in the book to some of the earliest theorists of political religions. The theory of political religions is not the theory I work in, but I think it holds great insight into the specific form of far-right politics that we're seeing now.
Paul, I wonder if you could talk a bit more about what role does genocide play in the thinking of modern fascists?
Yeah.
Because, I mean, modern fascists hide behind pseudo-intellectual terms like ethno-nationalism, but if you would put that into effect, it would actually mean rounding up people that don't fit into the image of your pure society.
Yeah.
And we've seen with historical fascism what that looks like. So how big of a theme is genocide within fascism today?
Yeah, here's where we have a problem, because you could argue that in the 1930s and 40s, the genocidal logic of fascism was played out in action only in extreme circumstances. And it was a result of improvisation. There is an argument, as you know, and I think your listeners will know, within German history about how much of the Holocaust was the result of top-down centralized planning, and how much of it was improvised by middle-level bureaucrats according to an ideology that they had learned 20 years ago in the early Nazi movement. I'm not dogmatic on this. I think that there is evidence of both. But you could argue that, you know, there was no real genocidal logic to Mussolini's fascism at the beginning, certainly not against Jews. He had Jews inside the Black Shirt movement. Today, genocide is front and center, because if you look at who are their intellectual heroes, it is Schmitt himself, it is Dugin, and neo-reactionaries like Guillaume Fay. So is Renard Camus, the author of The Great Replacement. It's playing with themes of genocide. And then we are fortunate because we have this rich history now. For example, of the Sturmabteilung, of police interrogations, of letters from prison, this kind of thing. You can see they hate Jews, but they don't know what a genocide looks like. You could argue that the Südwest, you know, Namibian genocide of the Hereros had given some Germans a taste of what wiping out an entire people looks like, but it wasn't an industrial scale modern genocide in that respect. You could argue that the Armenian genocide gave an example. But if you go in the Discord channels today of young far-right activists, genocide is a big theme. First of all, because they believe they are the victims of genocide, white genocide, genocide through migration and intermarriage, but also because they are fascinated by it. In the writing of the book, you know, I visited the Majdanek death camp and looked into the gas chamber, which still has the blue stains of the Zyklon B chemical on the wall. And it occurred to me that not only do they want to do that again, but if they did it, they would probably use the same places just to make the point. That's why we have to stop it. So we're seeing big organic movements where the far right, the extreme right, and the populist right are moving into percentages like 30 and like low 40% in some European countries, and indeed in America. So the alarm bells should ring.
And I think what's also important is to see the connection between modern fascist ideology on the one hand and radical conservatism and right-wing populism on the other hand.
Yeah.
You mentioned the United States, and I think Trump is a good example because he plays into themes like the Great Replacement and anti-feminism. And you can see that all over the world that fascist ideas are creeping into the political center, the so-called political center.
Yeah.
So I wanted to ask you, could you elaborate a bit more about the relationship between the new far right on the one hand and radical conservatism and right-wing populism on the other hand? Because one could argue, on the one hand, we have to be careful not to be too broad with the term of fascism, to say, for example, Trump is a fascist. But at the other hand, there lies a danger in missing similarities and connections. So how do you think about that relationship?
Yeah, I think the importance of having the separate categories is indeed, I mean, above all, in a place like Germany, where there is this law which says that there is a political police which must suppress fascism and indeed all anti-constitutional extremism, then it's not an abstruse academic argument, which is fascist, which is right-wing populist. It's really important. So the first thing to say is the most important thing is the convergence of all three, right-wing conservatism, populism and fascism around a similar intellectual structure is the new thing. However, what's the main difference? The fascists, yes, they fantasize about the collapse of the world and they fantasize about ethnic civil war and genocide. And their activity is structured to bring it about. So if you look at, say, on January the 6th, the Capitol Hill uprising, the fascists, so we see the Proud Boys and the Oath Keepers militia, who I would classify both as fascist groups of different kinds, they advocate and practice insurrectionary violence. Trump, at the other end of the mall, is on his platform. He is inciting insurrectionary violence, but he wants to do it for a more political reason. In background, he has, and we now realize this, he has a plan. He has lawyers working on a case. He has pressure on Mike Pence. And the whole aim of this is to force Pence to enact a constitutional coup, a presidential coup against the election result. We know this in far greater detail. We had the hunch on the afternoon itself, but we now know this in complete detail. So the relationship is well understood. Right-wing populist Trump wants to use the insurrectionary violence to achieve an authoritarian coup and overturn an election result. And that in itself, it's not fascism, but it's a very, very dangerous thing to be attempting in the biggest democracy and the nuclear armed democracy in the world. What does traditional right-wing conservatism do? You know, it facilitates it. It stands back and applauds. It says, hey, that was fine. And then when the prosecutions begin in Congress, it obstructs the prosecution. So we have a perfect worked example of how three of them work together. Here's the danger. And the danger is well understood from the relationship between Hugenberg's DNVP, the Weimar Republic, and the Nazis. Hugenberg thought he could use Hitler to create an authoritarian, reactionary, conservative, autarkic German project. That is, so Germany must have an empire, it must have room to live in Eastern Europe, it must repudiate its debts and become an autarkic imperialist economy. I think until the period of Schleicher, until December 1932, most people would put money on the outcome being the German right-wing industrialists will be in charge. Hitler will be their puppet. Even if he becomes chancellor, he's their puppet. And instead what happens is Hitler becomes chancellor, he's made chancellor, and in a series of coups between January 30th and the summer of 1933, it becomes a fascist state. So, you know, the danger is that modern fascism, even if it is quite different to the old fascism, it's leaderless, it's networked, it's quite internationalist, it still remains possible. What would we see? We would see in America a coup, you know, the suspension of large parts of the Constitution, the Supreme Court either turned into a form of government or sidelined from by the executive. You would see that. You would see states begin to enact fascist-style repression, arresting leftists, illegalizing anti-fascism, rounding people up. The apparatus, by the way, for that is there in the modern state. I mean, the Gestapo and the SS would look at most modern riot police, even in democratic countries, and say, that's amazing. That's amazing that you've actually been able to assemble miniature armies to repress your own people. If only we could get our hands on that, then we can turn it into something much darker. So that's where I think the differences lie and where the danger lies in a period of chaos. Fascists start doing things. So I point out in the book, one of the case studies is about when more or less the whole of the European far right went down to the Greek-Turkish border in 2020 to do a little miniature bit of symbolic violence, rounding up refugees who were crossing the river and confiscating their shoes and holding them at gunpoint while the Greek state did nothing. Well, that will start happening all over America in the kind of future Trump and his followers envisage. And so I want your listeners to understand, we're talking about the threat is within a decade. The threat is not like in the mid-century. The threat is this decade.
Yeah, and I think it's also helpful for us anti-fascists to think in processes of fascization rather than getting stuck in endless debates whether this and that regime is strictly fascist or this and that actor is strictly fascist.
Yeah.
Because that actually puts us in a better place to see the interconnections between certain lines of thoughts and to fight fascism from the get-go.
Yeah, and indeed, one of the historians of fascism who influenced me most was Ziv Sternhell, the Israeli left-wing historian, mainly of French fascism. Sternhell, in an interview towards the end of his life, opened it by saying, there are worse things than fascism. And he listed, it was possible to live in Mussolini's Italy until the Nuremberg laws. It was possible for Jews to survive in Nazi Germany. Ziv Sternhell points out that fascism isn't the worst thing that humanity has ever created. And I think that we must focus a little bit. Of course, the book came out well before even the preparations for the Ukrainian war began. But what we've seen with Putin, now Putin obviously has occasionally relied on far-right movements within Russia, and he has certainly encouraged far-right movements inside Europe and America. But Putin himself is not a fascist politician in the sense that he is a right-wing authoritarian who doesn't even need populism because he can rig any election he wants and crush any opposition he wants. He's the classic dictator, and he's become a dictator. What we didn't realize, I think we will find out once this is over, that Putin was radicalized while in power and has become very wedded to ethno-nationalist ideology. And the Ukraine war, its casus belli, is that Ukraine exists. That's simply what he says. Ukraine is an anti-Russia that should not exist. Its national ideology, its language, its national consciousness is an affront to Russianness, and therefore we are going to wipe it out. And we're seeing now Putin has to justify the war, and indeed some of the defeats that have been inflicted on him militarily. If you watch Russian state TV, it's wall-to-wall fascism. Mm. So that's something that I didn't expect. It's not something I anticipated in the book, but it's yet another confirmation that what we're up against. You know, I took part in a project called The Great Regression. Actually, that title is a great underestimation of what is really going on. This is not a regression. It's not a sort of conservative swing in Western society. It's a radicalization. It's the breakdown of neoliberalism and neoliberal ideology. And it urgently demands two things from us. Well, it demands of liberalism to decide which side are you on. Are you going to carry on repressing the left? Are you going to take part in anti-Muslim rhetoric? Or are you going to side with the progressive majority of society that wants to resist this drift to far-right ideology and fascism? And of the left, it demands action. It demands that we focus and prioritize. And as I argue in the book, we must learn the lessons of the 30s. Way too many leftists are stuck in the world of class against class. They're still fighting the ECB. They're still fighting von der Leyen. They still want to fight the battles of 2015. They don't realize that this battle is the battle for Western civilization. We are fighting for the Enlightenment. We could see, Dugin says, if we can reverse from communism to capitalism in Russia, why can't we reverse to a hunter-gatherer society? That's the scale of radicalism we're up against.
Mm. Yeah, I think every leftist should be aware of the difference between democratic and revolutionary anti-fascism, and they both have the right to be there, because I think capitalist inequality is a breeding pool for fascism, and we got to push for a better, for a more free, more equal society. So I think class against class is still a thing, but that fight should not make us blind for the threat to democracy itself, and that we have to ally with liberals to defend the good that we have. So that kind of brings me to the question of what kind of theory of fascism we need in order to fight it. Yeah. In your book, you dissect three positions: the liberal, the academic, and the Marxian perspective. So I wonder, Paul, if you could talk a bit more about what are their weaknesses and what is the modern theory of fascism that we need?
The first thing is that liberalism doesn't want to talk about fascism. It finds it very difficult to rationalize why it's back. Because liberalism doesn't have a theory of the world. If you talk to, and I don't mean just liberal politicians, I don't mean the FDP in Germany, I mean also social democrats. They don't have a theory of the world. They don't have a theory that capitalism blew up, neoliberalism blew up, partly because they don't have an alternative to it. That's their problem. The academic theories, one of the reasons I wrote this book is I was seeing young anti-fascists trying to juggle different academic definitions of fascism without realizing that these academic definitions are just research hypotheses. They're not a product of struggle. They're not owned by movements. They're just owned by increasingly abstruse post-structuralist historians and sociologists for whom, you know, the study of words and signs and symbols is more important than the study of reality. And I wanted to say, you know, I wanted to shake people and say, look, whatever definition of fascism we come up with, it has to be of a movement, of a process, of contradiction. Mm. And it's like, how do you define water? How do you define a stream? Don't waste your time trying to hone down to two sentences. Understand the process. Understand the reality in its movement and in its contradiction. And in that sense, the Marxist definition is the one we need to begin from. But of course, the Marxist definition, as inherited from the Comintern, is rubbish. It was rubbish then, and it's equally rubbish now. The idea that it's the military wing of finance capitalism brought about by mass unemployment. Well, you know, the finance capitalists today are some of the most liberal people in the world. Mm. For me, the key to understanding this from a Marxist, from a materialist point of view, is to understand it as a mass psychological phenomenon. Mm. And that's why two of the greatest Marxists, Fromm and Reich, are the people we need to begin from. And Gramsci, the greatest theoretical conquest Gramsci made about fascism was in 1921 when he admitted it's only partly a class phenomenon. It's only a partly fits in to our understanding of class struggle. It's got to be something different. And I think in his prison diaries, he does explore why fascism in Italy particularly took the form it did. But I don't think he ever came to any defensible theoretical conclusions. It is Reich and Fromm who come to the conclusions. Fascism is a fear of freedom triggered by a glimpse of people achieving freedom who shouldn't really have freedom, whether it's liberated women in the Weimar Republic, whether it's peasant socialists in liberal Italy. And it drives the people who it radicalizes towards violent ends, the idea of a violent world-ending insurrection.
Yeah, I think it's super important. In order to fight fascism, we have to understand what makes people susceptible for fascism and how they get radicalized. And there are kind of two explanations out there. The one stresses socioeconomic reasons and the other one more cultural reasons. And you, in your book, you write yourself, the return of fascism is a symptom of a system failure within capitalism.
Yeah.
But at the other hand, you stress the cultural dimensions when people are triggered by the liberation battle of black people of color, of women, of queer people.
Yeah.
And I think these two dimensions are too often put against each other, where we should see the connectedness. So how can we think about the connection between the socioeconomic dimensions of the rise of fascism and the cultural dimensions?
Just let me give you a concrete example. I went undercover on a demo which was called to protect the statue of Winston Churchill against Black Lives Matter. Okay, so the people who went on it were largely elderly football fans, men in their 50s, drunk, white. There were some young people and there were some ex-soldiers. So what made them get out of bed, get drunk, stand in the middle of London, fight the police, shout at the police, why aren't you arresting them? They kept asking, why aren't you arresting the black people? By the way, there were no black people around. Black Lives Matter had no intention of attacking Churchill's statue. What made them do this was the sight of Black Lives Matter on the street. It just triggered something in them that said, this should not be happening. There should not be mass demonstrations of black people in my country where the police can't control them. The police don't arrest them. They don't stop and search them. They don't put them in the back of a van and beat them. Or they are allowing them to march through the streets saying that their lives matter, by implication, more than my white life. So that was a perfect example to me of the fear of freedom triggered by the glimpse of freedom. The freedom is a multi-ethnic society, precisely a society where black people don't get randomly stopped in the street. And I was on the Black Lives Matter demos, and they were beautiful demos. They were expressions of huge solidarity and positivity. So these guys, okay, they have lived through 20 or 30 years of seeing the society they come from, small town Britain, ex-industrial Britain, decline. This drove them more and more to the right. It drove them to be anti-migration, anti-feminist. But I don't think until we saw a movement of black people that said, you know, we're not going to just become lawyers. We're not just going to become politicians. We're going to actually go on the street and say the police don't have the right to shoot black people dead. When they saw that in America, and when they saw their own type of people go on the streets, like this guy Kyle Rittenhouse with a gun and shoot people, it triggered something in their minds. And so that's what I mean by fear of freedom triggered by the glimpse of freedom. It happens because after 30 years of neoliberal poverty and 10 years of neoliberal breakdown, where there is no guiding, coherent politics coming from the center, these guys had just had enough. And I don't know where they go. If you can suppress them, sometimes they just retreat back to the corner of the pub, muttering insults about migrants. But sometimes they go online and they become more radicalized.
Just one last question, Paul. If we look at all that you said so far about the modern fascist belief system, the escalating crises within capitalism that could make people more susceptible to fascism, and also the psychology behind people getting radicalized and saying, I don't want to see freedom for people that don't look like me. So what does all that mean for the left? What do we need to do to fight the new far right?
For the left, it means, and Daniel Guérin spells this out in his book, The Brown Plague, written in the first year of the Weimar Republic, we only a living, breathing alternative can stop the rise of fascism. Of course, we are trying to defend democracy. We're trying to defend democratic institutions. But what we are not there to defend is the economic status quo. The left must argue for a radical transformation. And we saw in the first iteration of Jeremy Corbyn, the politics of Corbynism in Britain, we saw how that could work. We saw that it could mobilize people who are just sick of the present. They're sick of the way things are. In the second iteration of Corbynism, it just didn't work when we were up against a radical right-wing government. And we could discuss the reasons for that. But there are other examples. Bernie Sanders' movement. We've got to have our own goal. That's number one. Then beyond that, there are the anti-fascist tactics. And in the book, I list them. There are three. They're well known. First, we need an anti-fascist ethos. We need a cultural movement that says we are proud to be anti-fascists. Anti-fascism is a thing. Anti-fascism is what gave us Picasso's Guernica. It's what gives us the movie Casablanca. It's what gives us the Jean Renoir's movies. We need an anti-fascist ethos. That's number one. Number two, we need a popular front. We need an alliance of liberalism and the left to defend democracy. Any leftist who tells you that we can't, no, just ignore them. They are going to lead you to the same disaster that they led you to in the 1930s. And the third thing is we need militant democracy. We need legal structures that through which to defend democracy against fascism. And in Germany, there is one. You know, the state has the right to repress fascist parties, and it's just been used against the AfD. I totally support that. There are problems with it. It needs a strong policing of the police and the armed forces themselves. But I think more democracies are going to have to introduce such laws. And what does that mean? It means that the most fragile democracy is the United States, where such laws would be unconstitutional. The First Amendment gives you the right to call for genocide. The Second Amendment gives you the right to assemble the weapons to perpetrate genocide. That's the two First Amendments to the American Constitution. And the rest isn't much better either as a defense against what is coming in America.
One last bit, Paul. What is at stake when we fail in our anti-fascist battle and the radical utopia that we need to implement as leftists?
The radical utopia is not urgent. We need to fight for it. We need to fight for it in greener, a more democratic, and a more tolerant, and a more equal capitalism. That means radical change in itself. But the urgent thing is to begin decarbonization and to defend democracy. Those two things are like the tasks of now, of today when you stop listening to this podcast. Those things are the urgent things. What's at stake if we don't do those things are climate chaos will form the perfect backdrop for what the fascists want, which is global ethnic civil war. And if we lose democracy, you know, we now have three basically large imperialisms, the West, Russia, and China. You could argue four. The USA, European Union, Russia, China, however you want to split it. Russia and China just signed a pact to destroy the world order. 4th of February, the Xi Jinping-Putin joint declaration basically says the rules-based order is over. There are now multiple modernities, multiple definitions of democracy and human rights. And if you don't like it, you know, that's your problem. America, as I've said, is probably the most fragile of Western democracies. But Europe can survive. Europe can cohere. And I think the strategic autonomy of Europe is more and more important. But what's at stake? You don't have to look in the history books anymore. You just have to look at what happened in the Kiev suburb of Bucha. Mass killings, rape as a weapon of war, ethno-nationalist ideology pumped out 24 hours a day by the state media, leading to low-level, maybe even self-initiated, certainly crimes against humanity. And it's not a future problem, it's a now problem.
Paul, thank you so much for making time for my listeners. Thank you.
It's been brilliant. Thank you.